Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The cow-calf segment, again, we don't deal directly with them, but they are a vital part of the whole system, and they have to be healthy. They do have the opportunity to retain ownership of that calf all the way through the system, all the way through processing and on to the customers. So that opportunity exists today.
Dave McLennan, CEO of Cargill, testifying Wednesday before a House Ag Committee on market transparency.
As I said earlier, the profit through across all segments has never been higher. It's at least $300 or $400 ahead higher than it was even 5 years ago. And as we go forward, as the profits shift back to the production segments, the cow-calf segment is going to benefit from that, certainly.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is such an urgent hearing.
The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee from Georgia, David Scott.
As we just previously heard, the real challenges that our ranchers are facing. I don't know if you all, as the CEOs, were watching, but it was very impactful and effective. And our ranchers and those who form the first phase of our food supply line, our beef supply line, are facing critical issues. And I appreciate deeply you CEOs coming and participating, because we will not be able to find the right solution to help this first part of the supply chain, which you critically need, because without the meat, there are no meat packers.
First part of that hearing on Wednesday featured producers. The second part, CEOs from the four major packing companies.
I want to start with recognizing the three major components of our hearing. First, our consumers. Second, our ranchers. And third, our packers. And we are going to be examining questions about supply, about price, about affordability, and also about whether our ranchers who produce the cattle can afford to farm, to stay in business. As we heard from the panel today, the pressures are so great.
Chairman Scott setting the table for what that conversation would include.
From my own research, your profits are largely determined by what is called the meat margin. And the meat margin is the difference between the prices your four packing companies pay for cattle and then the prices that you charge for beef. Now, I'd like to display a chart. If we can look at the board there. This chart is based upon USDA data that shows that your meat margin has been raising steadily since 2015. Mr. King, it's 5 years before the pandemic began in 2020, and well before the supply chain disruption. In 2015, the year your meat margins started to soar, allegations were made against you that your four companies entered into an agreement to reduce supply and push profits up. And I think we all know that he who controls supply controls the price.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For those that aren't familiar, monthly I do this update, and you can go to agmanager.info and find this. The numbers I'm going to share here were as of April 18th. They were pre this cattle and feed report. For quick context, I was projecting for the month of April a positive return of $37. Looking out to June, it was plus $29, and that's when the story changes. So every month from July through November are projected losses.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonzer.
And what's really underneath that is notably higher cost of gain. So the cost of gain that's underneath that is in the mid-120s to the upper-120s. And yes, fed cattle prices are ahead of where they were the year earlier, but not enough to offset the combination of higher cost of gain and the fact that there's more being paid for the animals coming in the feed yard. So the three-legged stool of the feed yard, you know, obviously the operators are well aware of that. I put out the break-even numbers in the same report. Folks can watch that. But the break-even prices for fed prices approach 150 as we get closer to the end of the year, and we may well hit that. But at the time I did this for April 18th, coupling those futures prices with historic basis and so forth, we're not projecting high enough of a price to offset those higher cost of gain. And again, that was pre this report. So if you put a bow on that, the front half of 2022 still looks like it's going to be a profitable for an average cost producer in the feedlot industry. But that story changes sometime this summer. In this exercise, the month of July is when the profits turn into losses. This report will magnify that if nothing else changes. Improvements on cost of gain can go a long ways. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the grain space. My colleague Dan O'Brien's on weekly. You know, if we have something that improves things on the grain front, this story could change, certainly in the favor of somebody that already has cattle on feed, because anything that would ease those higher cost of gains that, you know, I'm projecting the upper 120s, there's chatter about some that are quoting 140 in the countryside. That's definitely pressuring these margins for the sector.
He also looks at the impact of regional reliance on major beef packers.
We're taking what we observe, USDA reports, federal inspected slaughter data, and I quote that at the national level when we do, you know, year-over-year changes, but they do that at the regional level. And we also know the presence of large facilities by region, so we can understand how different regions vary in the reliance on larger facilities. And if the pattern of disruption early in the pandemic of running those slaughtering facilities differed by reliance on large facilities. So the data enables us to do that. That's what we do. And in this report, basically we find a two-week period early in 2020 where regions that are more reliant on large beef cattle processing facilities, they had a larger year-over-year decline, but it was contained to 2 weeks. Outside of those 2 weeks, we find no statistical evidence. You know, I don't want to get too geeky here, but we find no strength to the argument that regions that rely on larger operations were more sensitive to pandemics. So all regions had to pull down, kind of regardless of the size mix is the way to think about that. I highlight that because it's a timely point. There's a lot of discussion about adding overall capacity. Some of that's well underway. It's not for me to say we shouldn't do that. That's not the point of my comment. But the real nuance of this assessment is the industry may not have been more sensitive to pandemic because it was relying on large facilities. So the move towards smaller facilities may not help as much as is sort of the default assumption. There may be a place for that in distributing them to get closer to certain operations or to, you know, just geographically having them in different spots of the country for other reasons. But in terms of national sensitivity and robustness of the system, this paper would say relying on large entities may not be as bad as some just presume it is. And the economist me has to add to that. We need to remember why the industry's evolved the way it has. And economies of scale and the ability to harvest an animal lower per head if you have a large operation and ultimately being able to transform an animal into edible beef products in a much more efficient way is core to that. We need to understand why, and not just understand, remember why, because it's been documented, the industry evolved the way it did. And studies like this kind of, they need to be kept in mind is the point.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
David McLennan, Cargill CEO. You believe it's okay to discriminate against an individual based on their race, color, creed, or national origin?
No.
You don't?
Interesting exchange at a recent House Ag Committee hearing featuring Arkansas Representative Rick Crawford.
I have in my possession some communication from Cargill that indicates otherwise. It says, working together with Target, Cargill has developed a supply chain to better connect black cotton producers with key markets and suppliers. This initiative was born out of comments we gathered in listening sessions with black producers and supports ongoing work around black farmer equity. Through this program, we're able to pay participating farmers a premium with no additional discounts for quality. We move cotton from the farm to our customers who are key suppliers for Target. It's been a successful program, but we continue to scale. Now, how do you square that with your position that you don't discriminate based on an individual's race, color, creed, national origin.
Congressman, you're referring to our Black Farmer Equity Initiative, something that Cargill is very proud of. Mm-hmm. As you likely know, less than roughly 0.5% of farmers in this country are Black. And so as part of our diversity, equity, inclusion efforts, we're supporters of our Black Equity Farmer Equity Initiative.
Are you including Hispanic farmers? Are you including Asian American farmers, or just targeting Black farmers in this case? Are you including other commodities? You had a laundry list of commodities that you produce or that you process that you mentioned in your testimony. Are all of those going to be paid premiums as well? And are all minority farmers going to be included, or just Black farmers? Are we also including women farmers?
Well, it depends on the country. If you're talking about the United States, we certainly will consider other focuses like the Black Farmer Equity Initiative. Again, something we're proud of. And I would add that it is something that our customer target has asked for and that their consumers are asking for in terms of more diversity in their supply chains. And with such an underrepresented minority, such as Black Americans, being involved in farming, we feel this is the right thing to do.
What about underrepresented minorities, for example, Hispanic farmers or women farmers? Has there been any desire from, say, companies like Target to improve outcomes for other minority farmers?
Over 1/2 of the world's farmers are women. So if you're referring to the United States, we certainly will consider...
What does this policy extend to? Is this African-American farmers, is this Black American farmers that you're extending this policy to? So in that case, what's the ratio of women to men farmers? What's the ratio of Hispanic to non-Hispanic farmers? What's the ratio of Asian-American farmers to non-Asian-American farmers? Are we really going after diversity and equity? Are we going after one specific demographic, or does this include everybody?
At this point, it's one specific demographic. It's less than 1 year old. And it is part of our DEI focus. So to expand it to other ethnic or gender-based groups, certainly that's something that we'll consider. I don't have the statistics.
Well, I have another concern in this statement that says that you're not making any discounts for quality. So that's almost an incentive to produce lower quality. And then you further on, you say we continue... you plan to scale that program. Can you elaborate on that, how you're going to not pay a discount or deduct a discount for a lower quality? You're paying a premium to the market, and then you plan to scale this. Do you not think that's going to have some impact on the market?
I think the integrity of the farmers that we deal with will show that they'll not only produce equal or better quality from what they have or what the market is producing. So I have confidence in the farmers that we're dealing with that the quality will not suffer.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think for a new facility to survive, they've got to offer something different. And one of that attributes is quality. The demand for quality beef is very high, and AMAs are a very important piece of that.
Tim Klein is CEO of National Beef. At a recent House Ag Committee hearing on transparency in cattle markets.
In terms of the cash market question, more cash trade today will not help the producer. Today, many of the cattle that are brought in on AMAs or other agreements are because the producer wants a guaranteed home for their cattle.
House Ag Committee hearing called price discrepancies, transparency, and alleged unfair practices in cattle markets featured two sessions. One featuring livestock producers, the other, the big four packers.
I believe that the future of the beef industry it's very important that all segments work together. The cattle numbers, ranches have dropped, cow numbers have dropped since 1980, but it was really as a result of reduction in demand for beef across the globe due to health issues at the time, and also ranchers' decisions to repurpose land. At the same time, we saw an improvement in the efficiency at the ranches, being able to put more pounds on cattle than ever before. So as I look forward, I believe that we're on the right track in terms of creating a quality product that is demanded across the globe. The profit opportunity today across all segments is greater than it's ever been. And that's because of the quality of beef we have in the system and the demand growth that we've seen, particularly in the last 2 years.
Doesn't believe the cattle industry will become vertically integrated like the pork industry.
Yeah, the average herd size today is 43 head, ranch size. So mm-hmm. it's very small, and they're not going to make a living on just that. So they've got to do something else. But it's a very non-integrated industry, and I believe it's going to stay that way. I don't see packers owning ranches. So I think the model that's in place today is a good model. The profits will shift back and forth. 2014 and 15, all the profits went to the cow-calf segment, and we were losing money. So these are the cycles that that we deal with every day.
Dave McLennan is CEO of Cargill.
Yeah, I think, Congressman LaMalfa, I mentioned it, perhaps you were out of the room, but this industry can't survive without the ranchers and farmers supporting it. And the American food supply has proven to be, system has proven to be incredibly resilient, as we saw in the last 2.5 years. But I think some of it is the cyclicality, which you alluded to, and one of the witnesses at this morning's panel alluded to the fact that the cycle is almost predictably 8 to 10 years, and that we are at the almost exactly at 10 years. And we are seeing evidence that economics are starting to shift. And we saw economics in the inverse relationship in 2013 and 2014. I think innovation is another theme in terms of creating efficient feed solutions for our ranchers and for our cow-calf producers to help them increase yields. But we all have a vested interest in the beef supply chain.
So what are the packers doing?
I think we're continuing to provide markets for their products. We're continuing to, I think innovation isn't down the road. I think it's here. And as I had said in my opening statement, we are anywhere from 30 to 35% buyers in the cash markets, which I know is something that many people have been speaking about.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
In my small town, as an example, when I graduated from high school, there was 1,000 people in that town. Now there's about 600.
Testifying recently before the Senate Ag Committee, Montana rancher and Senator John Tester.
There were 3 elevators, grain elevators. Now there are none. There were 2 hardware stores. Now there are none. There were 3 grocery stores. Now there's 1. And maybe the most distressing is there were 5 bars, and now there's only 2. Okay? So look, in order for communities to exist in rural America, we need to have a fair marketplace. And if this marketplace is consolidated, capitalism that works well in a free market doesn't work well in a consolidated market where there's concentration. And quite frankly, the end result of this is we've got ranchers that are going broke. Ranchers that are generational, that have been on the land 3, 4, 5 generations, are going broke. Not because they're bad operators, not because they made bad decisions. The model doesn't work for them anymore. And we need to do something about that, or we'll continue to see what's happened over the last 100 years. On the consumer side of things, what COVID did teach us is when you have big processors and it's hit with something like COVID, they have to shut down. Where you have thousands of people who are working instead of 100 or less, these close down. What does that do? It reduces the prices for the farmer and drives up the prices for the consumer at the retail level. And the fact of the matter is these packers are doing pretty darn well. Tyson Foods, in the last quarter of 2021, their net income rose from $469 million to $1.2 billion. That's one quarter, okay? Net income up from 2020 to 2021, up 47%. And by the way, I'm all about folks making money. I think it's a good thing. I think profit margins are great, and we ought to have them. But people, there needs to be some transparency. There needs to be some accountability. Because what we're having in this country is consumers and people in production agriculture treated unfairly. This is a moment in time, folks. We have an opportunity to do something. And I don't know what will be said at this table today, but here are the facts. We have a problem. Today's marketplace is more consolidated today than it was in 1921 when this body passed the Packers and Stockyards Act. Rural America is drying up because we can't get fair prices at the farm gate. Capitalism isn't working in this particular instance because of concentration and consolidation in the industry. Consumers are paying higher prices because without competition, they're set without regard to how, what people can afford. We need some sunlight. We need some sideboards. There were people that will say these bills do too much. There are people that say these bills do too little. I can guarantee you one thing. If we walk out of here today and we don't pass these bills, we will see the same result that we've seen for the last 100 years. And in the end, our food security is put at risk. You have a tough job ahead of you. You will discuss it. You will debate it. But please do the right thing. For the sake of folks like me who want to pass the farm on to the kids, it's not about inheritance tax. It's about making sure we get a fair price at the farm gate.
Montana Senator John Tester. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Good afternoon, Chairman Scott, Ranking Member Thompson, and members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Tim Shellpepper. I've been part of the U.S. beef and food and agriculture industry for more than 35 years, dating back to my first job out of college in 1987.
Shellpepper testifying before a House Ag Committee hearing on price discrepancies, transparency, and alleged unfair practices.
I joined JBS in 2017, and I became CEO of JBS USA this past January. I'm also a proud fourth-generation farmer. My wife of 31 years and I operate the farm that I grew up on, which my great-grandfather originally settled in Nebraska in 1887. Our land sits in the heart of cattle country, surrounded by farms and feedlots, many of which supply cattle to JBS. I am both a friend and a customer to many of my neighbors. JBS USA produces in Pilgrim's Pride, the second largest poultry producer in the United States. We employ 67,000 team members, mostly unionized across the country, and we contribute millions of dollars each day to local economies through purchases of livestock, poultry, and plant supplies. At JBS, we strive to create a better future. Our success has allowed us to strengthen many small towns and give back to our rural communities. We are investing $100 million to support local projects through our Hometown Strong program. We are building new recreation centers, improving access to affordable housing, and refurbishing schools and parks. We care about our team members and their families. We offer full benefits and recently dedicated more than $150 million in annualized wage increases to our employees in our beef division alone. Our average facility wages are nearly $24 per hour, with starting wages at or above $20 per hour. We've increased wages by more than 40% since 2017, and on average, our wages are 25 to 50% higher than many local businesses. We provide upfront free community college tuition for our team members and their dependents, with a goal for our program to become the largest privately funded free college community college initiative in America. JBS is dedicated to improving the sustainability of our operations. We've committed to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2040, and we'll invest $1 billion to reduce emissions from our facilities. By 2030, we will invest $100 million in on-farm research to help producers reduce their emissions. In recent months, we've contributed $1.3 million in climate change research projects in partnerships with NGOs and universities, including a $700,000 contribution to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln to help build a new feedlot innovation center. Now, I understand that one of the topics of this committee would like to address today is the pricing in the cattle and beef industries. Historically, cattle were sold in lots, and every animal in the lot received the same average price. To achieve a better return on their investment, cattlemen created alternative marketing arrangements, or AMAs, with processors. AMAs allowed producers to realize premium prices for their investments in genetics, animal health, management, and marketing. They also help ensure a consistent supply of quality cattle, which results in a consistent supply of high-quality beef for consumers. For our part, JBS purchases from cattle feeders and producers of all sizes in cash markets, auction barns, video auctions, and under AMAs. We are active in the cash market every day, and we will compete for quality cattle in the market wherever and however producers wish to sell them.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, the placement definitely did, but you know, with that is the on-feed is higher than expected because obviously that feeds into that.
K-State livestock economist Glenn Tonser on the latest cattle on-feed report.
The on-feed for April 1st came in plus 2%. That was notably stronger, so about 0.3% was expected, and nobody was expecting the full 2% growth. Now, that was driven by the March placements, as you said. March placements came in flat, where all pre-report estimates were having it down. The actual number was well outside the whole range of all the pre-report estimates, notably higher than expected. I should interject here that April 1st inventory is the highest on record since this series has started since 1996. And then the last main national number we'll hone in on is the March marketings came in 2% down from the year before. That number was not a surprise, so that's right in line with what was expected. So marketings as anticipated, placements were quite a bit larger than anticipated, and with that, on-feed inventories to start the month of April were up compared to what we were thinking going into the report.